Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
Hey, it's Peter Melman.
I'm here with the moderately sponge-worthy Hannes Finney.
There we go.
And the totally shrinkage-worthy Chris...
And you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finney.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from the Pleasure Chest down on Santa Monica Boulevard.
In West Hollywood. I've been there.
Boys Town, as they like to. You've been in the store. Well, of course you have. We're here right now.
Oh, no, but I've been here even before we came. I've been to the Pleasure Chest.
Nice. And what did you purchase there?
You know, I didn't purchase anything. I did a lot of looking. I saw some things that kind of caught my eye. But at the end of the day, I'd rather just get those items on Amazon.
If you go to storywithpodcast.com and click on the Amazon banner,
we can
get a taste of your sexual deviancy.
Okay, so we're tonight at the Pleasure Chest because our topic tonight is the meaning of 69.
Yes, yes. And 69, automatically, I laugh like a small child. 69. By the way, I don't even know if this is what we're going to be talking about.
Right.
But the act of 69 is, just to me, it's a lot of work. Distracting from my pleasure.
What it is it's multitasking.
Yeah.
So we're trying to receive pleasure, but then we're trying to give pleasure. So there's I'm working, I'm off. No, I'm working.
Yeah,
I'm on
and
the clock,
why do human beings have to redo everything? Like, nature has come up with the perfect thing. You have sexual intercourse, you both get pleasure and give pleasure at the same time. But we're like, no, we'll perfect it. We'll
Here's
figure out some other
69.
Way.
69, you have to like relax into it. Do you know what I mean? If you are getting into weird positions and then you feel like you have to like double back to do different things.
And you better be, your partner better be approximately the same size as you. You know who never did 6'9"? Wilt Chamberlain. Because he never had sex with a 7-foot woman.
Oh my gosh. Well, I don't know. There's something to it. But especially if you're a kid and somebody's talking to you about 69, I can't even imagine what you would picture that to be.
It's just funny because you don't even know what it is, and it's just in your head. Like as a child, you heard this once.
Well, one time I used to walk to the bus stop with Larry Dayton, and he told
me Dayton, that bastard.
He owes me $10.
Yeah.
He would say to me, he would laugh at me because I didn't understand the word saltpeter, and I don't think I even understand it now. What is saltpeter?
I believe no, it's not a saltpeter. Saltpeter is a
spice.
It was supposed to be something to, I believe, enhance erections. Or was it destroy erections?
No, I think it's destroy.
It was destroying the erection. Like if you put saltpeter in your food, you wouldn't be able to get a boner.
But that's what kids do to each other. They taunt each other. You know, you don't even know what you're talking about. You don't even know about 69. You don't even know about saltpeter.
I like what George Carlin said when he was 70 years old. He says, 69 is my favorite number. Now I'm 69 with a finger up my ass. George Carlin,
that's
quality humor. Anyhow, we're probably being disgusting for no reason. Our fantastic guest
that's
has probably
right.
brought this number to
teller.
Us without a dirty thought in his head. And
that's
he is
right.
the amazing.
Peter Melman is here, folks. And he's got a story about the meaning of 69. So we're not going to delay. We're not going to go on and on and on and on.
Our usual bullshit that goes on for about an hour and a half.
But I did want to mention, you guys,
cut that off.
If you'd like to support the Storyworthy Podcast, that would be terrific. And here's what you can do. Head on over to storyworthypodcast.com or storyworthymedia.com, and there you'll find our brand new mailing list.
That's right. We're going back in time. It's back to the future. We're starting a mailing list.
There's nothing wrong with a mailing
list. Everything's going backwards.
I'm not going to bore people.
Records, it's
gonna
be a newspapers.
Quick little note on Monday mornings, and it's just going to give it a little taste of what's ahead.
Yeah, there will not be any long things. Like, you know what I did this weekend, Christine writes.
No, and nothing touchy, nothing like that. And if you want to unsubscribe, you can do that. But subscribe to begin with, and that would give me a lot of pleasure.
Yeah. Have you not got enough bullshit coming into your email account? Well, here it comes.
You can also follow us on Instagram at Storyworthy and on Facebook, of course, Storyworthy, and on Twitter at Storyworthy. So it all comes back.
You're getting
back.
A sense I'm getting here.
Yeah.
You can also buy your book.
Buy my book, Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life. It's selling like hotcakes.
It is like a Tom Clancy novel. It's so
thick. Compared to the book that our guest has written, I feel like I'm looking at a brochure. Do you know what I mean? Or it pamphlet. Is. There's nothing here. This is.
I know.
Not,
you've actually
vapid.
Got pictures in it because you're like, I don't have enough pages. My life is so thin.
You know, I wanted more pictures. I really did. But it's expensive. Like to get all the add those in and stuff. And you pay the graphic designer to format it and to add the thing. And this is time. You know what I mean?
Oh, my God. This is where the Kindle comes in.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a great storyteller here tonight, Peter Melman. I'll tell you, Hannes, I've been looking into this guy. Content aplenty.
I believe that was his nickname in college, Content O'Plenty.
That's the name of his new album after he does Gravel on the 405.
Gravel on the 405.
Exactly. Ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are, stick around because Peter Melman is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have comedian Travis Clark.
And I'll be talking about the games children play.
That's next time on Storyworthy. Hey, Christine, tell everybody about our social media consulting business.
Well, Hannes, we have learned so much over the last 5 years doing Storyworthy about social media, and we've had so many guests on the show that have given us their tips and ideas.
Yeah.
And so now we are sharing our experience with others. We've started a new social media consulting business, and if you email us at info@storyworthypodcast.com, I'll be happy to fill you in on exactly what we're able to do for you.
Yeah, we can increase your social media footprint.
Exactly.
Exactly. Footprint!
Again, email us over at info@storyworthypodcast.com and I'll be happy to email you a rate sheet.
Hey, it's Fred Stoller. You're listening to Storyworthy. Is that what it's called?
We're back. We've left the pleasure chest. We're now sitting on a bus bench on Santa Monica Boulevard with a big bag full of dildos. And, oh, I'm sorry. I went too far.
You know what? The dildo thing,
I'm saying it's embarrassing.
I've never been interested in that sort of thing.
Objects.
Never been interested. Maybe because I had a C-section, nothing big like that size has ever gone through this particular organ.
I like how you're pointing in the direction JJ, like I can't figure it out.
My body parts.
Yes,
bathing
yes.
suit parts.
Bathing suit parts. Yeah. The C-section, by the way, that's a sexual conversation stopper. Right there. You're like, you know, perhaps, you know, I had a C-section. All right. You had your belly cut open, human being ripped out. All right. I'm out.
Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Melman's here right now. He is a producer and a writer, and he's written for just dozens and dozens and dozens of publications. But he's probably best known as the writer for the television series Seinfeld, of course. 8 years on Seinfeld.
8 years.
But he also had that show, It's Like You Know, which mm-hmm. came out like in 99, I believe. And it was kind of like Seinfeld. But it was based in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I really liked that show. More recently, Peter wrote and produced the half-hour show Blank. Have you looked that up, Hannes? Blank?
I have not seen it yet.
It is so funny. You can find it on YouTube. You guys have to watch this. Blank. It's won a couple of awards.
I'll do it using my new Apple TV.
Oh, yeah.
I'm very excited.
Good for you. Welcome to 2015.
Thank you. It's very uncomfortable for me here.
He also did a series called The Narrow World of Sports, which this is a show that you can binge watch. I watched at least 15 of these. So instead of The Wide World of Sports, it's The Narrow World of Sports. And he does these
clips. And it's like coming around because he started
and does
in sports
3 to 4 minutes
for the Washington Post.
That's right. And so he does 3 to 4 minute clips with very famous athletes. And it is incredibly humorous. So you guys look that up, The Narrow World of Sports. And he also received huge praise for his 2014 novel, It Won't Always Be This Great. He's also written books about Mandela. He's just a wealth of content. You can find him at his website, pemelman.com, and also on Twitter, @PeterMelman. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Peter Melman.
In 1967, football jerseys were a teen fad in New York City high schools. The world was decades away from maniacal sports marketing, so the jerseys were bloodless. No team logo, no team colors, no superstar stranger's name along the upper back, just white jerseys, striped shoulders, and a sullen, boxy number. The fad seemed radiantly dull until a trend emerged, the number. The number was the same on every jersey. I was preteen and groping. 69. Why 69? Why 69? Why 69? My father had tickets to the New York Giants, so I was up on the NFL. Number 69 on the Giants was Willie Young, a left tackle notable for standing over a crumpled quarterback, freshly mauled by the right defensive end.
Young's responsibility. During one game in our bleacher seats at Yankee Stadium, a virtuoso drunk sitting behind us shouted, "Young, you're a fat shit." Shriveled in embarrassment at hearing such filth in the presence of my father, I nevertheless sensed the fad could not be centered on a fat shit. 69 was beginning to feel like it had nothing to do with football at all. Confirmation came on a busy day at a delicatessen on 188th Street and 73rd Avenue in Queens, where some older kids cackled from hearing the counterman shout, "69, number 69. Consciously oblivious, adults fingered their cash or glared down at the smoked whitefish, hoping they'd jump out of their walleyed deaths and bite one of these snickering premature ejaculators on the ass. If anything other than sex led kids to laugh and parents to play dumb, I wasn't aware of it. Then, as now, I was completely incapable of stopping my thoughts from drifting to undesirable places. At 11 years old, all mysteries were dark mysteries, and all dark mysteries involve sex. Actually, let me back off on that a little bit. I'd recently heard the previous summer referred to as the Summer of Love. The activities entailed in a summer of love were lost on me. It sounded groovy or maybe even out of sight, but it was no dark mystery. I was unaware of any connection between love and sex, so I couldn't be bothered. The cases that consumed me were breathier. A psychedelic shop called Bell Book and Candle opened near me, just around the corner from where a few months earlier kids threw snowballs at Mayor Lindsay in protest of the city's slow cleanup after a blizzard. While looking at strobe lights, I heard one of the oppressively relevant DJs on WNEW, the legendary progressive rock station, talk about the Doors song, "Light My Fire." "It's great sex music," he said. "It has the long version for regular sex and the short version for a quickie. On these airwaves, we only play the long version." Quickie? Now there was an intriguing term. I looked it up in the dictionary. Quickie. A book or movie produced in very little time. You know who never got a lot of pussy? Noah Webster. Another fascination came in October when my classmate Eddie Clark peered down to his right during Glee Club and whispered, "Gail Morrissey has a great ass." That one threw me for two solid days. A great ass? Is that something I'm supposed to be looking at? It took me years to realize there were freaks for every body part and a specialty magazine for every freak. Back then, I merely finessed my way around that one. Okay, I'll look at asses. I'll talk about asses. I'll compliment asses. I can do that. After all, there they were, every day in every class, asses lined up in alphabetical order. But 69, that was different. It couldn't be so easily dismissed. The number was the fad, and it had to mean something specific and crucial to this, the cheeriest country on earth. The case would take years to crack. Seeing as this was a sexual investigation, I ditched the dragnet procedure of starting my search close to home and expanding outward. It wasn't like I could canvass my own household. I assumed recreational sex was something new, maybe invented around 1965. And my father, working on 23rd Street in Manhattan, and my mother at the office of PS 179, were too absorbed in making America great to possibly be up on the latest in fornicational chic. I used to look at them and their friends, wondering how it was possible they'd all had sex. Now I look at my friends the same way. What goes around is even more appalling when it goes around. Although I should mention that my parents, after a Broadway show, did bring us to Max's Kansas City, the hottest New York restaurant among the burgeoning hippie scene. Ooh, look out, you rock and rollers. Here come the Melmans. All the crazy long hair and off-smelling smoke was scary and thrilling, as was the girl who smiled at our out-of-place nuclear family, then flashed us the peace sign. Seeing as her braless breasts, if used properly, could have inspired the Viet Cong into unconditional surrender, my father flashed the peace sign back to her. Maybe my parents would know what 69 means. No, I couldn't do it. Confidential sources would have to be cultivated outside the home. I considered possible educators. The first was Kenny Kantrowitz. Despite doing his second tour of fifth grade, Kenny had an impressive grasp of all matters taboo. He didn't let his fixer-upper of a brain keep him from staying in touch with those who had zoomed past him into sixth grade. Sixth graders at PS 26, they knew stuff. The plan was to sidle up to Kenny and mention that on a math test I'd gotten the grade of 69, then hope he'd break into his Jurassic laugh and explain everything. On a Friday morning, I went up to Kenny in the auditorium as he labored over something he could just about identify as a book. He seemed grateful for the interruption, so I launched part one of my plan. But when Kenny more or less congratulated me on my math score, I nodded and walked off toward the front of the auditorium. My friend Anthony Milano asked me what I talked to Kenny about. Math, I said. Anthony gave me this faraway look, which was understandable, as it had only been a few weeks since Anthony had convinced Kenny that Mount Rushmore was a natural rock formation. My second source was Gary Lauer, a perfect combination of older, friendly, and pitiful. Due to his huge nose, Gary's nickname was Face the Nation. Considering the constant abuse Gary took for his prematurely gross profile, I hoped he'd be flattered anyone would seek him out for anything. I caught up with him as he watched pickup basketball in the schoolyard. Gary never played sports. He just watched, as if he were a season ticket holder to his friends' lives. On this day, 3 of the 10 players were wearing 69 jerseys. Perfect. Little Mel, what's up? Gary said pleasantly to me. I opened with basketball talk, noting that Phil Schoenhout couldn't dribble to his left. Gary said, no, he has no left hand. He has a right hand and a non-right hand. I laughed. Gary had the kind of lively sense of humor I'd associated with aesthetically tragic people. I reasoned that there had to be some special dispensation from God to make up for the tyranny of chromosomes. Pleased by my laughs, Gary made more jokes. I laughed more. Fun. We were having fun. So I threw it out there. Boy, what's the big deal about 69? Gary's nervous system high-jumped, his face going all gargoyle, as if he were seeing himself in the mirror for the first time. What did you ask me? I backpedaled. The shirts with the numbers. Oh, forget it. Too late. Face the Nation bolted up and waded into the middle of a fast break. That's how much this couldn't wait. He grabbed Phil Schoenhout and whispered to him with Cold War urgency. Phil's braces, which required only slightly less wiring than the Triborough Bridge, sprung forward. He went to his right even to wave other players over, who one by one buckled in laughter. I blew out a side exit of the schoolyard. I ran home, just full tilt, my head baggy with questions bigger than me. Tearing through a path between two buildings, the exact spot where Stephen Squirsky told me about the president being shot, I bumped into Teddy Scharf. Teddy was 6 months younger than me, and yet he was wearing a 69 jersey. Where did you get that shirt? I said, all Perry Mason. Teddy got nervous, real nervous. It's my brother's, he said. I grabbed it out of his drawer. I thought, you know, everyone's wearing 69 shirts. I don't know why. I just looked up 69 in the Giants yearbook. It's Willie Young, and he stinks. I don't get it. Does 69 mean something? What does it mean? So Teddy was also on the case. His research was a week behind mine, but I decided we could partner up. I brought him up to speed. He nodded like a newly deputized narc. We went silent for a few moments, contemplating the world over our heads. On an ensuing weekend, I walked home after hanging out at Eddie Clark's house, where he continued talking about Gail Morrissey's ass as if it were something hanging in the Guggenheim. I started home with upwards of a dollar in my pocket, so I stopped at Lorenzo's, a pizzeria next to a bowling alley known as The Hole. I was feeling cool around The Hole, as I'd recently bowled my high game there with a ball so light the pins practically had to be bribed into falling. The 16 lanes were downstairs from a nondescript doorway on Union Turnpike, and the street outside became a hangout for older kids. I got 2 slices and a Coke, and boy, information really rides on random currents. You just got to stay open for business. 2 guys walked into Lorenzo's just as one said, "Believe me, I think he's full of it too, but he swore that he 69'd her in Cunningham Park." I grabbed my pizza and Coke, ate on the move, and ran to Teddy Scharf's house. I just learned something really big, Teddy. What? Teddy whispered. What? I paused to let the moment gain weight, then came out with it. 69 is a verb. Teddy's eyes widened as if to say, holy crap. This was confirmed when he said, holy crap. I nodded, yeah, holy crap. We stood there processing. It was getting cold and windy and raw, and in 8 months, Bobby Kennedy would be dead, and America would be in Chapter 11 for the rest of my life, and damn it. Teddy looked up at me and said, you're shivering. I thought he was going to ask me in his house, but instead, Teddy, in his 6 months late on everything hopelessness, said, well, I don't know what the hell 69 is all about, but I'll tell you this much. When 1969 rolls around, all hell's going to break loose.
That's a great story. Oh, that is so beautiful. Awesome. Now listen, are you Facebook friends with these guys?
No.
No. Have you ever heard from them again?
One of them, Evan, the guy who was always talking about Gail Morrissey's ass.
Yeah.
I heard from him on Facebook once, but I kind of like,
yeah.
You know that whore.
And where's Gail Morrissey? That's what
I'm
interested
in. Yeah, where's that whore? I mean, girl.
I don't even know. I have no idea, but, you know, it's amazing how, just like the rest of the internet, Facebook is like such a, like, for every good, there's the equal and opposite bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, except for the internet, it's like for every good, there are 12 bad things.
You think that's the ratio?
Yeah, I do, because it's like...
I don't think that. And I think there's a lot of good in Facebook. I mean, I understand that it can seem pithy, but it's, you know,
it is about the whole internet in general. It's like I can find a million things that I'm...
Oh, my God. You can complain about anything.
I really can.
What's that about?
The good thing about Facebook is, you know, like, you could just unfollow them.
Yeah, I
have to see them.
Right. I have a list of people that I have to block. I mean, it's not hard to do at all.
You probably have like 3,000 friends, right?
I think it's almost like 5,000. It's ridiculous. They only let you have 5,000, and then you have to,
page.
You have to be something else, yeah.
Now, you, how of those 5,000, you know?
I bet I know 500.
Yeah.
Maybe even 800, because there's a lot of people in Pittsburgh where I'm from. And there, I definitely go back and forth with some people from high school, little jabs and little comments. It's quite humorous. I enjoy
it. The weird thing is that we're now in contact with people that we should never have seen again. Not that it's that dramatic, but it's like all the people that I know from high school on Facebook – chances are I would never have heard from them
unless,
or thought
like,
of their names again.
Unless somebody would have sent you from back home, if your mother were alive and she were in Milwaukee, she might send you like a little clipping like, oh, look who got married. Or,
yeah.
You know, look whose house burnt down or something like that. But now you get to see what they had for breakfast.
Yeah,
day.
And now I'm like, oh, you work there? Oh, you got divorced? Oh,
okay,
it's like...
But you like Twitter. You use some social media, right, Peter?
Yeah, I do some Twitter. I do some Facebook. I'm so fun. It's so funny. Like, you know, like I get followed on Twitter by total strangers, and then I look at their profile, and they have like 25,000 times more followers than I do.
Right.
Yeah,
what is going?
Yeah,
on
like
here?
What the hell did you do?
I don't know
to
how the
qualify.
Algorithm gets how it shakes down. I'm really not positive. It's
isn't it
it's
like,
tricky though. But as a writer, Twitter would be fun because of the wordplay. You know, keeping it short and keeping it. Yeah. What?
You know, I have things come up and, you know, you have funny thoughts and what do you do with them? You know, so sometimes you could put them into whatever you're writing that day. I have been doing a little stand-up comedy, so I put it into that now.
Yeah, that's good.
And so, you know, by the time I get down to Twitter, it's like the eighth priority.
Yeah, in other words, why give it away when you might be able to use it in your act?
Yeah, I know. Every time I think of a joke, I'm like, I could write the – oh, wait, I should –
yeah,
do
I mean,
that
it's
my
so
stand-up,
much better
which I
in
need
like
to get back to.
Yeah. It's so much better in a, you know, in an article or a story or whatever.
Okay, so let me ask you this. When did you write the story that you just told us?
I wrote this story probably about 7 years ago.
Yeah. It's interesting how when there's a memory from childhood. So I'm sure you still have other childhood memories that you have not written down.
Yeah.
And you remember them so clearly.
That's some of them.
Yeah.
I've actually started keeping a page on my desktop called basically memories where I put the year in and just little jottings of something that I you know, I'm trying
it's
to
so
just
smart.
Like remember things.
Yeah, it's so smart. And do you use an iPhone?
Yes.
So when I, like during the day, you know, I leave notes for myself all the time.
Right.
Do you do that? That's smart.
Right. Yeah.
And then it sends it to your email box.
Right. I usually enter them in on that notepad thing just
yeah.
because, you know, once you like actually write out the words,
yeah, but you can just say, make a note. You know what I mean? Make a note, Peter Melman, and then it'll make your note.
Oh, with Siri?
So watch this. I'll go, watch this. Make a note, Peter Melman.
Got it.
Oh, this is podcast gold.
That goes right to my email. So this tonight, when I'm thinking about my day, it'll come up and I'll think, oh my gosh, I met Peter Melman today.
I'm going to...
Really? You can't remember that on your own? What do you do? You need to more ginkgo biloba or something.
I'm going to say this right off the bat. I'm so mad at myself that I don't have your book. Here, it won't always be this great. I really meant to have your book with me, and I don't have it. So I'm going to get that.
If I had known, I'd have brought you one.
Well, I'm telling you, it looks like such an amazing book. And I was reading a little bit about it in the LA Weekly, and I wanted to quote something that they say in the LA Weekly about the book, It Won't Always Be This Great. It's a novel about being fascinated by the way that you can lead an incredibly uptight, respectable life and then do one little tiny thing wrong and everything unravels very easily. Sometimes I think about that on the freeway. I think, like, if I just did my wheel to the left, we got trouble.
But see, that's
unbelievable how fragile your existence is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Life is absolutely fragile. So let me read this from the LA Weekly. It begins with a relatively simple incident and quickly spreads downward from there. Imagine the teenage Holden Caulfield, all grown up, converted to Judaism, and now a successful, wealthy podiatrist living in Long Island with a beautiful, witty wife and two wonderful kids. At the advanced age of 51, he endangers his wonderful world with an impulsive act. This is so, Hannes, this is so... I don't know. It's so Larry David. It's so Woody Allen. It's so Peter Melman.
Well, it's like a whole genre of like you think that you're normal and you think you're living this life that's preordained. And that's like,
right.
No, you can, if you do, you deviate one thing.
Okay,
and
so
the whole thing will just
fall apart.
What
happens. While walking home in the sub-zero wind chill of a Friday night, he stumbles on a bottle of kosher horseradish, badly sprains his ankle, and in a rage, he mindlessly throws the bottle through the window of a popular store selling slutty tween fashions. This isolated antisocial impulse turns his life upside down, bringing waves of fear that he'll be caught by crooked cops, the FBI, and a newspaper reporter whom he uses to manipulate the story while attempting to evade suspicion. So it's like George Costanza.
But like, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Everything that I've done, you know, everything you do influences what you've done, you know, the next thing you do. And, you know, I mean, Seinfeld and had some impact, but you know,
right, but you had
Washington
an impact
Post
on Seinfeld too.
And
it's like it's all part of the same thing. It's like it made me think there are people like us at this table who would worry about stuff like that, and then there's Donald Trump as the most obvious example at the moment. People who just will say and do anything and have no interest in anyone else's opinion about anything. It's like they cannot be brought down by your disapproval of them.
Well, there's a part of me that admires that.
Yo, I wish I was more like that.
Like just caring about what people think is so wearing on you, you know?
It is?
I think you don't quite realize how much you don't want people to think badly of you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like that, like, you know, over tipping in restaurants and stuff like that. You know, like sometimes I think, what do I care?
Well, you care because you can, number one.
Yeah.
And because you know you're going to make somebody's day.
Yeah. But, you know, the funny thing is, in something that most people are incredibly insecure about, like doing stand-up, I don't really care about the audience. You know, most stand-up comics are up there just love me, love me, love me.
Yeah.
And I don't even, like, acknowledge that they're there.
Good for you, man. Good for you.
I mean, to tell you the truth, half the time when they're laughing, I'm thinking, just stop it already so I can move on.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I know. You're just interfering with my performance.
Yeah, you're just getting in the way.
I mean, I've done stand-up, but it didn't last because I wasn't funny. But storytelling, I can get up in front of any audience. I don't have but if there's an expectation that they're going to laugh, that would put me under some pressure.
The expectation level is the rough part.
Yeah. Okay, so I've written down some questions I want to ask you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You live in Venice.
I lived in Venice. Now I live in Santa Monica.
Oh, how was the drive over here?
Not great.
Yeah. Do you use Waze?
I used my iPhone.
But
GPS.
Waze, you used the...
I have Waze, but the iPhone was totally right. I just thought maybe it was like off because that turn into center.
Oh, I know.
Was just
I know.
Too weird. But
off Sepulveda here, there's that funky little turn to get to center drive west. I kind of make it in the notes, but not everybody.
Yeah, I don't read it.
Waze is a really great tool because it's current traffic and it leads you around the traffic.
I have Waze.
It works well. How often do you get your car serviced?
Whenever the Audi dealer tells me to.
Oh, man, you're a sucker. They tell you so much earlier than you need to.
Really?
Yeah. Although I do like an Audi. Those are nice cars.
But they don't. It doesn't cost anything.
Oh, really? When you change the oil and
when you buy
stuff?
A car of that quality, they just do it for you.
It's just a standard. Yeah,
oh,
they just
really?
Do it for you, yeah.
So if you buy an Audi, they just service your car for life?
Well, any of those luxury car dealerships, they do that kind of thing. I don't know because we're driving crap.
It's a lease. I have a three-year lease.
So they want to keep it nice.
I guess. I mean, you know, they're very service oriented.
Don't you think 3,000 miles is a bit low to change your oil?
I know so little about cars, you can't imagine.
All right.
Yeah, this is.
I'm just asking some questions.
I'm just wondering how many downloads we're going to get when we put this in the search engine. Oil changes too soon?
These are all good questions.
Is your passport current?
Yes.
Where are you going?
Westwood.
No, come on. Where do you need your passport?
God, I haven't been away in a long time, but I'm thinking of either, you know, I have a lot of friends in London and Paris and a few friends in Australia. So
all good places, all good choices.
Yeah, those places. I'm not going anywhere like Africa.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm not going anywhere.
This one over here, Miss World Travel, she's like, I want to go to Vietnam. It's like, what are you, out of your mind?
I went there.
Yeah, that was great, right?
Vietnam is great.
Exactly. See, there you go, Hannes.
That's one of my jokes, by the way. That's
really?
One of my stand-up jokes that's probably going to get me killed, that I said one little thing about, like, how I went on this vacation to Vietnam, and I always go, like, I don't understand what those Vietnam vets were whining about. I had such a good time.
Yeah, why did they need that R&R in Thailand anyway? It's a nice place.
I know. My old assistant who just got married is Vietnamese, so, you know.
Go over, see the Wat Po, you know, whatever.
It was great.
Yeah.
You
are not married?
No.
Right, and no children?
No.
What do you do with your money?
Do you want to invest in the podcast?
I'm not exactly sure. Investment-wise, I don't really look
at... No, I was kidding.
I don't look at the statements, really. Yeah. I guess I'm doing okay, I think.
No, but what do you do?
What I do is I just buy and spend whatever I want, mm-hmm. whenever I want, you know, within reason. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't think about a $500 purchase.
Right.
That's the big luxury.
Right.
I don't think about it. I mean, I'm not I'm not like an overly lavish person, mm-hmm. but, you know, like, I just, you know, I needed a new sofa and I just was like looking on websites and things like that. And I saw this one I loved and I just bought it without thinking about it.
Yeah. What's it like?
I could show it to you.
I'd like to see it. I mean, are you like a modern guy?
It's like mid-century modern.
I love mid-century
modern. There
you
go.
Is
that's
it black
quality
leather?
Right there.
No, it's yellow.
Yellow leather.
It's not the leather either.
It's not leather. What is it?
It's real mid-century.
Oh, wow. It's, so it's like
so
a
it's fabric.
Yeah. And it's kind of slightly.
Did you buy a house in Santa Monica?
Yes.
That's a beautiful area.
In Resta Canyon.
How lovely. That's wonderful.
Where is Resta Canyon? I don't.
It's between the Palisades and...
Okay, so it's up a little bit north.
Yeah. Oh, wow. You guys, I'm looking at this yellow couch. It's fabulous. It's really great. So two big cushions and then two big cushions on the back as well. So it's really trim line, which is mid-century
modern.
Can I
see? Yes. Can I
see? And I love the artwork on your walls, too. It looks like Hockney.
That's beautiful.
It's Liechtenstein.
Oh, it's lovely. Good for you, man. All right, here's a question. Have you tried Uber?
No. You know, I was in Uber. I didn't do it, but somebody got me an Uber car in Washington, D.C. once.
Oh, that's nice. Uber is another really great resource, especially if you don't want to deal with parking and, you know, you just want the professionalism of a car there. I work for this bookstore, right? And a couple of months ago, I did this event, I kid you not, with Lady Diana's brother, Charles Spencer.
Oh, really? Wow. What happened to him? He kind of peaked at the funeral, I thought.
Listen, you know, I almost said to him, like, I am so sorry about your sister. I didn't say that, but I wanted to.
I'm sure he would have been appreciative.
Nicest guy in the world. And I stood with him while we waited for his Uber car for about 10 minutes at the end of the night because he was just by himself. And I thought, well, maybe I should wait here.
Famous people are often by themselves more than you would think.
He asked me if I needed help with my car. And I said, no, but I'll be happy to stand and wait for your car with you. Anyway, my point is that was a great example of a guy who's got some money and what a wonderful way to use it in terms of not dealing with traffic, parking, you know what I mean, gas.
Right.
Anything? Yeah.
You were talking about D.C. How long were you? You lived in D.C. and wrote for them.
Well,
right?
I went to University of Maryland, which is only about 9 miles outside of Washington. Okay. And then I was at the Washington Post from in 78, 79, 80, and a smidge of 81.
Nice.
And then you came out here.
Then I went to New York.
Oh, then you went to New York. And you worked with Howard Cosell?
Yes.
And tell us about him.
Howard Cosell was the most fun person to be around, and, you know, I love them, and, you know, we did a sports journalism show, and you felt like you were really in the middle of the sports universe because, you know, he was the guy. There's never been and never will be anyone like him, you know.
Now it's so diverse. There's so many channels. There's so many people. But he was the guy.
Bill Simmons kind of now.
I mean, times 10. He was, for like 10 years running, he was listed amongst the top 10 most admired and top 10 most hated Americans.
How funny.
Simultaneously.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was only three networks then, you know, and he was so focused. There was so much focus on him, and he was so controversial, and he was so different than everybody else.
And because I don't know a lot about Howard Cosell. Why was he so controversial?
Well, he did not have a television voice. He didn't have a telegenic face.
Yeah, everything about him screamed, you should not be on television.
Mm-hmm. And yet, he constantly brought the real world into sports, which was the first person to do that. So, you know, he was invading the viewer's pleasure. He was like reminding them that this is not Camelot, that sports is part of the real world. And he showed all the hypocrisy of it, and people didn't want to hear it. Some people did. Smarter people wanted to hear it, but most people, they just want to see that game and get out of their heads and be totally mindless. And, you know, it was best portrayed in the 72 Olympics, where there were two guys who fiddled around on the victory stand.
Mm-hmm.
Two black guys who won a race, and they fiddled around on the black, and he interviewed them. And after that interview, he was getting all kinds of telegrams calling him a nigger loving Jew bastard.
Wow.
Because he was so fair to them. On the other hand, there was a black track coach who misread the schedule and didn't get his runner to the race on time. And Howard was very tough on him, asking him all the pointy questions, and he got a slew of telegrams on the other side calling him a total racist.
I see.
I mean, this is what he was like. He was a lightning rod.
And he came from a background in journalism, I believe.
He was a lawyer.
He was a lawyer. I'm sorry. He was a lawyer. So that's the way he treated it.
He was a labor lawyer.
So you already had your love of sports, right? Because you'd written for the Washington
Howard
Post.
Howard actually kind of canceled out my love of sports.
What do you mean?
Well, he made me see so much hypocrisy in it, and he made me so disdainful of sports fans.
You mean the inequality of money, or what do you mean?
Oh no,
Go ahead.
You know, like, you know, the owners hold, which is still going on today. You know, they hold up cities. You know, like a football team owner will say, "We're going to move cities unless you build us a new stadium with taxpayer money."
Yeah,
I mean, Howard was talking about that stuff in 1975.
That used to piss my dad off, and my dad would be like, "What do you mean they want to build a new stadium? They didn't pay for Three Rivers Stadium that they built in '69, and now they want to build Heinz Field.
Yeah,
who's buying this?"
Right now, back in my home state of Wisconsin, it's like they're gutting the University of Wisconsin system to the tune of $500 million at the same time saying they'll pay $500 million to build a new stadium for the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah.
And I want the Milwaukee Bucks to stay in Milwaukee, but I also want the University of Wisconsin to still be a great university. It's like,
but isn't that why the all the corporations own those stadiums now? I mean, don't they?
They don't own them. They
like
only pay to put their name on them. Staples doesn't own it. They $50 million.
So the taxpayer buys the taxpayer pays for the stadium, and then the corporation pays $10 million to have their
name on it.
$100 million to have their name on the stadium, and all that money goes to the owner of the team and not back to the citizen. You know, it's
I did not realize
this goes on in sports. This kind of stuff goes on all over the place.
Okay, so this is fascinating. Now you create the show The Narrow World of Sports, which right off the bat, why aren't you doing that anymore?
I don't exactly know.
It's so entertaining.
I had so much fun doing it. And that was basically my reaction against ESPN because I can't stand ESPN. So I just wanted to ask the kind of questions I wanted to ask.
Oh, God. Right. I know they cannot get their lips off people's asses.
So let me set this up, you guys. If you haven't seen The Narrow World of Sports, Peter basically chooses a sport. So maybe he's going to interview Misty May Traynor, a volleyball player.
Right.
So then Peter has a desk out in the sand with like a light that's clearly not plugged in and maybe a name plaque. And you're sitting there at the desk, maybe a baseball cap on, and you know, you introduce the show. You're on a volleyball court. Or you were with Sugar Ray Leonard in his home gym or whatever. Right. So you set it up, and then when they come on, you ask every question they've never been asked.
Right.
And so you really get to see the real athlete. You see person.
I think it's much more revealing.
It's so telling.
Than you ever see them. I mean, you know, I asked Kobe Bryant, you know, like, if you score 55 points and the team loses, why do you have to feel bad?
Yeah.
And he goes, and he just laughs. He goes, I don't.
Yeah. And Danica Patrick, cutest girl in the world, shows you how to drive a race car. You on the couch and you're using a pillow as a steering wheel. That was so entertaining.
I know. And it was great asking her, like, you know, if she gets a speeding ticket, do you get to write it off?
Right.
On your taxes?
Yeah.
Because that's research.
You asked her if she would drive with, if she were pregnant, would she drive down the freeway in a car pregnant like that? And she said, no, it's not a good idea. But this is what I guess I'm curious. So that show, The Narrow World of Sports, it's just so clever and it's so fast and it's so, and so I guess once you make all the money in the world, do you still have a passion to say, like, you know, that should be on Adult Swim or that should be on something? I mean, why aren't we seeing
You have all the money in the world?
You know, well, first of all, I don't have all the money in the world.
No, but you're certainly comfortable.
I'm not Larry and Jerry, you know.
But you also don't have children and you don't have a wife.
Yeah.
Right. So that's going to free up some money right there.
Well, it frees up stress is what it frees up.
old joke where the guy gets hit by a car and somebody, you know, says the ambulance is coming in. He puts a pillow under his head, says, are you comfortable? He says, I make a living.
Yeah.
So let me ask you then, do you have that push to make The Narrow World of Sports bigger? I mean, it gets thousands and thousands of downloads.
I would, you know, kind of like to keep doing it, but I don't know. It just didn't present itself immediately. And, you know, I'm like really into moving on.
Okay.
Whatever the next thing is, I just want to keep.
And so the next thing for you, is it more writing more novels?
I have another one just about done.
You do? And what's that about?
This one's really crazy. It's about a girl in the South who's about 18. She goes to a boarding school. She's kind of like from a white trash family, but she happens to know for a fact that in a previous life she was Sigmund Freud.
Oh, wow.
And in this life she doesn't want, and she remembers everything about her previous life, and she doesn't really want to get involved in that kind of thing anymore, and yet she's constantly having to talk kids off a ledge.
Now, when you write a novel like that, are you going from front to back, or do you do an outline first, or how does it differ writing a novel than writing sitcom scripts?
I am going front to back, and I don't really map it out, and it's hard to differentiate between the two only because in scripts I never really settled on one method.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it never really worked out the same way twice on any two Seinfeld episodes. You know, like, it was, you know, Seinfeld was the first time I was working in a creative setting, and I was basically learning on the fly how to be creative, you know, and so the system never quite worked the same way twice.
But there's rules in writing a sitcom. aren't there?
Not Seinfeld.
Really?
Yeah, that was a
Seinfeld
whole different
broke
way.
Seinfeld broke most of the rules.
Because sometimes
that's why
they would write things that on paper were not a joke, but you knew who was going to say it. And when, you know, when Julie Louis-Dreyfus says this, this is going to be hilarious. You know, kind of like that.
You know, the tough part was figuring out the stories, you know.
Because there's four different storylines. When you write for an ensemble, you're writing not just one story.
Interweaving them.
And it always seemed to do it brilliantly.
It used to work out, yeah.
So are there any episodes that you didn't care for?
Oh, yeah, tons.
Tons? Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Can you just name one off the top of your head?
You know, I never liked episodes that were really huge and unrealistic. You know, I didn't really like, you know, doing an episode about the Puerto Rican Day Parade.
What about Bubble Boy? That was
Bubble
huge.
Boy I liked.
That was too funny.
Bubble Boy was pushing the edge.
Yeah.
But I liked it a lot. It turned out to be really funny.
Really funny.
You know, that whole season was unbelievable. You know, it got a little harder to keep the stories as small and slice of life the more the show went on because, you know,
all of a sudden
you're 150 episodes
in. Yeah, you're burying a body in Central Park.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but I took a lot of pride in adhering to the original Larry edict of the show, which was, you know, tiny little slice of life story.
Yeah, I just have to say, we don't want to, you know, obviously you've done a million things, but The Hamptons. Probably my favorite episode.
Oh, great.
Ever.
I love that one too.
That's and in not just shrinkage, which of course is enter the vocabulary, but there's a joke in there. It's you just make me think of like not a regular joke. It's like they see the topless George's topless girlfriend.
Boutros.
He goes, Boutros Ghali. And Jerry goes, Yo Ma. Yeah. And Elaine goes, nice rack. It's just so the rhythm of it was like so extraordinary.
It's so funny, you know, like when you're in the middle of it, because in that episode, I'd written this run about, you know, George saying, it's funny how the tomato never took off as a hand fruit.
Yeah.
You know, and while we were editing the show, you know, every episode we did was like 6 minutes over, 6 minutes too long.
Yeah.
When we finished the edit, which is another difference between Seinfeld and every other show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't care about being long. We liked editing it down because it sped up the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Got rid of the fat. But, you know, we needed to cut for time. We were down to like 20 seconds we needed to cut out. I said to Larry and Jerry, we could just cut the tomato run. And Jerry looked at me like, are you kidding me?
What are you talking about?
Are you kidding? And, you know, like I wrote it and I was like, oh, okay.
You could leave it go, yeah.
You like it.
So what character did you like writing for most?
Jerry and Elaine.
Yeah. What about even the minor characters, though, like George's parents? I always think they're very funny. The way they screamed, everything was
They were very easy to write for, you know. They were, you know, those extreme characters, especially the outside characters, were kind of easy to write for. But, you know, like I didn't really want to kind of need them.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want to.
You always stuck with the four.
If it was possible, I wanted to stick as much to the four and have those characters pushing the action rather than outside characters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But anytime they were in Florida, in Jerry's parents' house, you know, all that association stuff, that's all very, very
It was
humorous.
All really fun.
Very humorous.
It was
Jerry
really
still
fun.
Is one of those guys. It's like he walks in and I start laughing.
Yeah, he's a riot.
This is really weird.
And the sweetest
makes
guy.
Yeah, makes fun of me because I've been watching these old game shows and Tattletales. Do you remember that? It was horrible. It would have like a cup and it was Stiller and Mira and a couple's on. Mm. And it's like 1972 and he's exactly the same. He's just beautifully, exactly, wonderfully in amber, the same guy.
His line readings in Seinfeld were pretty much dictated by the fact that he was getting a little older and having trouble memorizing.
Yeah, yeah.
So the lines would kind of like, be stilted and then kind of like fly out of him.
Yeah, very
As
natural.
As he suddenly would remember
it
and then
his
words.
Natural.
And suddenly it seemed like, wow, this was a really
Well, the whole
doing.
Idea that the show was about nothing, I think, was a little misleading because
totally
it was,
misleading.
In fact, completely everything.
Everything.
Funny.
Everything.
Almost every
other show in the world is about nothing.
This was about all the little things that you don't pay attention to.
All right, here's the question I have for you. If the cast of Seinfeld at the time got into a fisticuffs with the cast of Friends, who would have won?
Oh, Seinfeld would have killed him.
Yeah, there's only one fighter on Friends. That was Joey. Yeah. The rest would have run screaming in the...
Yeah, totally.
Once they thought NBC wanted us to do one of those shows where...
A crossover?
A crossover night.
Oh, God.
So different characters appear on another person's show.
And Larry, of course, immediately rejected the idea. And I had said to Larry, I said, wait a minute. If we have Ross on our show... And we kill him. What if he died? What if he dies?
That would have been a great thing for America to do.
That is funny.
Wasn't Paul Reiser on Seinfeld as just a little bit?
I don't think so.
I'm trying to remember. Was that Kramer? The guy who lived in Seinfeld's apartment was Paul. It was Paul Reiser's apartment before he moved on. I'm Mad About You, because every once in a while you'd reference Mad About You as Susan's show. It wasn't a direct crossover. Did I just make that up in my head?
I think you just made that up in your head.
Wow. I'm going to go back in time
Peter,
next to
Peter, do you play any sports at all?
Yes.
What do you play?
Basketball.
Oh, right on.
I'm a huge basketball player.
And do you play like in the park or is there a court?
I play in a few games where people, renting out gyms at Crossroads and
Crossroads at the high school?
Yeah.
That's funny. That's really interesting.
Sometimes I just play in the park.
We've had so many guests who went there.
I have really too much game to quit at this point.
Is that right?
Yeah, I have so much game I don't know what to do with it all.
And so do you like to go see the Lakers play?
I love the NBA.
You do?
I love NBA basketball more than anything.
So do you go to the games?
I do go to games. I don't go to as many as I used to. I don't go to as many as when I was a big earner, so your agents would be taking you all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I would think that at the Staples Center that they would want to see your face. You know what I mean?
I know the publicist.
That's what I mean.
So he's really cool.
And he would say, come on down. Come to a Kings game. We'll put you on the Zamboni. Have you done that?
Not quite that, no.
You see, Peter, you haven't done anything.
I haven't done. I hardly leave the house.
Well, we know somebody who can get you on the Zamboni.
I'd like to be on a Zamboni. I'd like to take. Wouldn't it be great to take the Zamboni to Starbucks every day?
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yes. I have a contact for that Zamboni. I'm going to hook you up.
She's not kidding.
I'm not kidding.
She's got them.
Did you ever take the police helicopter ride along program?
No, but I would be very interested.
I did that once.
Did you? Was that a researching thing, or did you just want to be in a police car?
It wasn't a police car. I was in the helicopter.
Oh, even
police,
better.
A police helicopter.
Unbelievable. How did you get to do that?
I knew somebody who knew somebody, and somehow I was like, yeah, I'd love to try that. Because I'd been on a helicopter. Once Larry David and a few other people went to a Yankees game in Anaheim, and Larry couldn't bear the idea of the traffic
in front of five.
He rented a helicopter.
Good for him, man. Good for
him. That's a guy with all the money in the world.
Because life is short, and it's later than you think.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You are so right. And, so the helicopter, of course, was the most comfortable thing in the world, that one, for $2,300 and 14 minutes.
Yeah.
It was unbelievably comfortable. So I was thinking, I get motion sickness from just about everything, but I appear to be cool on helicopters, so I'll go on this police helicopter ride. And of course, the cops are like, "Oh, we're gonna make these guys throw up."
Yeah,
they're literally like chopping along, and then they go
purposefully,
and then they go, "Oh, there's the Playboy Mansion." They'll dive down, they go to the top of a building, go look out to your left, and then turn over you're jumping off the building.
It makes me sick to my stomach to even think about.
I'm telling you, I would never.
How long was that ride?
I think it felt like a month.
Yeah.
It was about 2 hours.
Whoa, that's a long time. As I understand, in a helicopter, maybe I'm making this up, but as much time as you spend in the air, you have to double the time on the ground for maintenance. Does that sound crazy?
It doesn't sound crazy.
Okay, you're saying there's so many moving parts that they have to make.
Yeah, 15 minutes in the air, you got 30 minutes on the ground.
Okay.
And then you go back up.
And it really gets crazy when you're actually doing one of those things where they're circling a block.
Yeah, were you looking for crime?
Well, they what happens is they get the call on their radio. So there was something going on in Hollywood. We went all the way from like Malibu,
yeah,
to Hollywood.
In
and
seconds.
They were circling this block, yeah, over and over, and you're leaning over. You know, it's like
makes me so sick to my stomach. Yeah,
yeah,
but how fun! Did you have a headset on? Could you hear what they were saying?
We didn't even need a headset. They were right there.
I know, but it's so loud. Isn't it really loud in a helicopter?
I don't know. I don't remember if I had that. I mean, this is like a long time ago, like 15 years ago.
What is it about pilots that they love to make their passengers sick? They always do this, yeah, where they're like, hey, you know, you're going to be a Top Gun pilot, so we'll put you in the back of this jet. And they always want to make Tom Cruise throw up or something.
Yeah, and then they want
to, like, a toy.
They want to do those roles.
The loop-de-loop,
yeah. It's like a toy for them, though. You know what I mean?
In a million years, I would never do those things.
Do you know you can Uber an airplane? That's another idea. See?
Really?
Yeah. You go on a date. You want to really impress a girl. Uber a plane up to San Francisco just for, you know, dinner. See? Wow.
To see, like, the opera, just like in Pretty Woman?
No, I wouldn't see the
and
opera.
And you give her a thing to...
Where do they pick you up? You have to go to the airport.
You probably have to go to the Van Nuys Airport, but you could go to the Santa
Monica
Airport.
To the airport.
No, yeah. You just go right to Ocean Park Boulevard.
Right.
And then you're there.
That's where we got the helicopter.
See?
From.
That's what I'm talking about. Hey, listen, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Do I have a choice?
No. Music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the storyworthy wheel of truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Passport. Can you believe it? You know, one year I was deciding that I was going to go to Europe or something like that, and I said, oh my God, my passport is expired. So I ran to the passport off. You know, I got the photo, I got the old passport. I did everything like in a day. I was totally jammed up with doing this passport thing, and I forgot one item. I was on this line outside the federal building for like 4 hours, forgot one little thing, mm-hmm, had to go home, go back on the line for like 3.5 hours, got finally at the end of the day, I was like the second to last person they were going to see that day. I got everything in for my new passport, and I handed in my old passport, and the clerk looks down at it and says, God, you know, this one doesn't expire for another 6 years.
Oh, God damn it. Oh, my God. That's such a great story.
I read the date wrong somehow.
Peter, that's so funny. That's a great story. In 1 minute and 2 seconds. Look at that. You see how this game works? No matter what you land on, you're going to have a story.
It is really kind
you
of
know, something.
You know, I've never landed on when we play it in person, but I just realized that I got a passport in 1991 for 10 years. And it expired on September 11th, 2001. I remember looking at that date and thinking... I mean, I just remember looking at 2001 going, God, I can't believe that's going to happen. And then when I looked at it again, I was like, holy shit.
You know they last 10 years. A passport.
Well, now he does.
Yeah, now I do. Five. That's
a kid's is 5 years because, of course, they change. Like, my daughter got one when she was like, I don't know. I had this thing. I thought she had to have a passport. We never went anywhere.
I think that's why I did it. I think that's why I did it, too, because I was helping. I have 3 godsons.
Aw, that's nice. Where do they live?
They live near the Santa Monica Airport, Santa Clarita, and Paris.
Oh, wow. Okay, so here's what you do. You get that Santa Clarita one and the Santa Monica Airport one. You Uber a jet out of the airport, and you go over to Paris.
Yeah.
Pick that one up, you know. Go on down to Cannes.
No. Here's what you do. You pick up the one in Paris, the one in Santa Monica. You take them to Santa Clarita, and you say, look how good you've got it.
Yeah.
Well, what are you complaining about?
Well, Paris is a little freaky now, I'll tell you that.
Why do you say that?
I mean, it's
great, but you know, these are like Jewish people in Paris, and it's not a great time. And this kid's like a really rebellious kid, so he's like puts it out there. You know, usually like Jews in Paris, even before
keep
all
it on the down low.
Shit,
yeah,
they keep it a little on the down low. You know, and I mean, he's not religious at all, and you know, we every time I talk to him, we joke about, yeah, God,
yeah,
you know, like, yeah, you know, like we're the biggest atheists in the world,
yeah,
you know, like. But it's scary.
What's he doing over there?
He's in starting college.
Like at the Sorbonne, or
no? Actually, he's going in Rome.
Mm. He's going to school in Rome.
Yeah,
that's not in France.
No, he grew up in France. Oh, but he's like really French. His mother was a good college friend of mine.
How nice!
And she has lived her adult life in France.
So let me ask you: could you ever see your book, It Won't Always Be This Great, being made into a movie?
You know, I haven't really given it that much thought.
Because it's very every man. It's like, the every man story. I love it.
I'm sure somebody could do it. But, the funny thing is, it's like only in L.A. would people desire to write something and have it adapted to a lower form.
Yeah.
like a novel is like up here and a movie is down here.
I think it's two different art forms. I don't think you can.
But it's like, I've created this piece of art. I wonder what someone else's interpretation of my piece of art would be.
Exactly.
I don't know. I don't know.
If they did it, that would be nice.
Okay, who's one of your favorite authors? Who do you like to read?
I like John Updike, Laurie Moore.
Of course.
You know Laurie Moore?
No.
She is so fantastic.
Give me the name of one of her books.
You should read her short story
books
because that's what she's the great.
I will.
Birds of America.
Okay, Birds of America. Now, have you listened or have you read Tom Perrotta?
I have not, but I know he's really good.
He's so good. And there's an example of a guy who writes these fantastic novels and then they get adapted into books then they get adapted into movies that hold up. Like Little Children. You know what I mean? It's like, wow.
Yeah,
He's so good. Great. Oh, come on.
Yeah, Little Children. It's funny because, I always think like, the better a writer is, the tougher it is to adapt because their voice is so important.
Yeah.
Like John Irving.
Yeah.
The movies that they made.
The World According to Garp. That was good.
It was good.
That was the good one. There were a whole bunch that didn't.
But if you read the book first, you don't like it as much, because the book was so unbelievable.
Right.
The book was
there was a whole weird lack of structure that he would do. That was hard to capture.
And the Hotel in the book, which was I thought was even better book than Garp, really.
Oh wow.
But then they adapt it. And there's a woman who wears a bear suit in that because she's so ugly. And then they have that part played by Nastasia Kinski.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Oh, how funny.
Not getting the
not exactly that unattractive.
Yeah. I once saw Nastasia Kinski like in the '80s.
It's Catwoman.
No. Oh God, cat people.
Ooh. Cat people, that's different.
The one. Yes.
But I remember walking on 57th Street and seeing this woman walking towards me from 80 yards away.
And it got hot.
And having this
warm.
This feeling like, oh my God, that's like I can't even see her and that's the most beautiful girl in the world. And then when she got close,
those people are amazing. I was an extra in The Aviator and I was like, as far away from Cate Blanchett for hours as you are. It's like you can't even it's like looking in the sun. They're so good looking, it's crazy.
Wow.
They have a physical, it's like they physically change a room.
Wow. Wow, those are big words.
Charlize Theron.
Yeah, I've heard that about her.
I was in a theater one day and she walked in and the whole place was like.
Well, she's 6 foot tall. You can't miss her.
She's pretty hot.
She's amazing. Yeah. And she's a great actress.
She is a great actress.
Hey, listen, thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, my God.
I really
appreciate
it.
Yes, thank you.
Such a pleasure.
Yeah, really, I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You take with me the gift of Uber, the gift of Waze.
Yes.
And Pit to LAX, my story worthy.
Pit to LAX, my story worthy life.
You can read it in the back of an Uber.
All right, you guys, we're going to wrap it up right about now. I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Maria Spertolozzi. Thanks, Maria.
You're welcome.
You're so adorable, and I know you're doing a good job because I hear myself clearly through these cans is what we call them in the industry.
Cans. Gets back to 69.
I'd also like to thank Roddy Swearengin and Sean Merrick. And of course, John Thomas Griffith. He wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
I deny all knowledge of his existence.
And of course, on behalf of Peter Melman, again, thank you so much for coming
on
our show today.
And thank you for the hours of pleasure you've given to America.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schleichinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.